Buddhist Summer School, Wednesday, 27th August, 1980. Yesterday, we completed our considerations with the second jhana, the passage through what I call the first portal of death, with the realization of the complete silence of discursive thought, that is the silence of all speech. And we considered very briefly the significance of this silence, because speech represents our existence in the state of mortality. Everything begins, proceeds, dies. And all our thinking is in connection with everything, everything which begins, proceeds and dies, with the world of mortality. And when that subsides, the question arises, in what manner are you conscious? And this is one's first experience of being conscious in the manner of immortality. There is no death taking place in your consciousness. Otherwise, we are conscious of everything as it arises and dies. The birth-death cycle is over in the second jhana. Now, the Buddha, in his discourse to Sakuludayin, it's a very long discourse, it's in the second volume of the Majjhima, he tells Udayin that the whole, in the jhanas, the whole body is drenched, saturated, permeated, suffused with rapture and joy. Now, with the first jhana, there is freedom from bodily pain. How that applies to those bhikkhus who suffered from severe illness, I don't know. But this is the general statement. With the second jhana, with mental grief disappears in the second jhana, because all our mental grief is associated, after all, with our existential experience in the world of things, in the world which is the mortal world. Bodily pleasure ceases with the third jhana, and mental joy ceases with the fourth jhana. In the fourth jhana, there is only mindfulness and equanimity prevailing, exclusively so. The mind is in the unified state now, completely one-pointed, completely unified. There is no separation between conscious mind and subconscious mind and so forth. It's the mind in its wholeness, in its purity. The psyche has been completely purified. So, mind, that archetypal transcendental energy, is able to function through this purified psyche. Now, although all these states of pleasure, joy, etc. have disappeared, and there is only mindfulness and equanimity, there is full consciousness. One is clearly conscious, in fact, for the first time, so to say. And one would ask, consciousness of what? Now, that is the more or less unanswerable question. One is getting into tune with the infinite, right enough. The release out of bondage to that which comes into being and dies spells the entry into that which does not originate and end. It's what they call the ekagata state, the unified state. And there the mind is self-contained and functioning unfragmentarily. With applied thought in the first jhana, there is no sloth and torpor. That disappears. With discursive thought, sustained discursive thought, doubts can be resolved. And when the doubts are resolved, then the discursive thought begins to disappear. Rapture gets rid of hatred, and the joy which one experiences right up till the fourth jhana means that worry and flurry, restlessness disappear, and there is only mindfulness and pure attentiveness, which eliminates greed. It's rather significant that the elimination of greed takes place as a climax. After all, we start life experiencing greed. You watch a little baby suckling its mother, and if mother thinks that the baby has had enough and removes the baby from herself, watch the reaction of that baby. The deprivation of the satisfaction of desire, of in this case greed for food, raises a violent reaction. So craving and resentment go together. If craving is not satisfied, there is resentment. Now, from the fourth jhana onwards, the meditator enters the samapattis, as they are called. Now, samapatti is translated usually as attainment. In the Pali dictionary, it's given as attainment. But I think that the Sanskritists use the word coalescence, which I think is a better way of putting it. Now, what happens? With the fourth jhana, there is a going down of all sensory perceptions. By passing quite beyond all perceptions of form, by the going down of perception of sensory reactions, by not attending to perception of variety, by becoming aware that akasha is immeasurable. Akasha is translated as space. It also, in ordinary language in India, means the sky, akash, the sky. Its meaning from the root kash, which means to shine. The sky appears bright. And so akasha is that which is bright, is immeasurable. One enters upon and abides in the plane of infinite akasha. Infinite space also, if you like, and infinite akasha. Space as the void which is the source of the plenitude. So, what happens is that one's own mind now becomes at one with the entirety of the void. Attainment is not a good word, I think, for this reason. Where attainment is concerned, there is always a relativity present. This is the lesser, this is the higher, and you attain the higher. But in terms of infinity, how can you attain anything? The infinite is infinite, non-measurable, non-finite. There is no here in contradistinction to there. It's infinite space. Nothing is attained as such. There is therefore this coalescence of the mind with what we may perhaps call the universality of mind. Mind, the archetypal, cosmical expression of this primordial creative energy which brings everything into being. Then the next stage goes on to the infinity of consciousness. And at this stage, after this stage, by passing beyond the plane of infinite consciousness, the meditator becomes aware there is no thingness here now. When he enters upon that state and abides in that nothingness, in that no-thingness. And then, passing beyond that, he enters upon and abides in neither perception nor non-perception. Now, these words are not to be interpreted in our ordinary sense. Perception, in that mode of consciousness, is a transcendental awareness. It is not perception in our sense of the word, where we use our eyes or our ordinary thinking process and perceive this, that or the other. It is a transcendental perception, quite almost impossible to suggest words which might give some inkling of this kind of perception. But it is a state in which one can produce a thought which is quite independent of any perishable source which could be the stimulating force to bring about a thought. All our thinking is dependent upon that which is around us, or that which is working within us. But here one produces a thought and one perceives in a way which is entirely different from this. You know how in the Diamond Sutra they talk of perceptions, that the Tathagata has taught that perceptions are no perceptions, and therefore they are called, therefore this is called a perception. It's the name perception persists in order to suggest that in the full awareness, the complete realization that the ordinary perceptions are no perceptions, that is a true perception. The language is always a little bit difficult. And then one comes to that ninth stage, the final stage, by passing quite beyond the plane of neither perception nor non-perception, one enters upon and abides in the stopping of perception and feeling. In this stopping is called the cessation. And this stopping, in terms of consciousness, is described as vinyanam anidarsanam anantam sabbato pabham. Vinyanam is discriminative consciousness, and discriminative consciousness can function only at our ordinary everyday level, and in the jhanas too, the first four jhanas up to a point. And then discriminative consciousness undergoes this transformation. It becomes anidarsanam, without any characteristics, without signs, anantam, endless, and therefore it is beginningless. It is not something which is born, which uprises and then perishes. It's anantam, endless. And sabbato, everywhere, pabham, shining. This is what in mystical terms one may call the light of transcendence. It's this kind of consciousness. But do remember, it is not a consciousness in terms of a subject and an object. It is not that I am conscious of this, that or the other. But there is the awareness of transcendence. It is not that you enter into it, but that it takes possession of you and it shines through you, because the psyche is completely purified and the whole being, the living being there, offers no obstruction whatsoever to that. No one enters nirvana. No identifiable person enters nirvana or the kingdom of heaven. It is nirvana which manifests through you, the perfected, purified one, because now your purification offers no obstacle to nirvana manifesting itself through you. It is transcendence itself which realizes itself through you, the instrument of transcendence. God manifests through you. That is why the great founders of the religions and so forth have been worshipped as God incarnate. Jesus, the Son of God. Sri Krishna has been regarded as God incarnate and so forth. So now, in this state, In Buddhist terminology, is the final state, when nirvana, one moiety, one half of the task has been fulfilled. The other part of it is this, wisdom, which sees the truth of things, sees the void nature of everything that is manifest. The void nature of that, of everything. And in seeing that, one naturally has put away any attachment or any grasping of in the manifested universe. And when those two are, when that is there, all the asavas, as they are called, completely cease. The word asava is translated usually as cankers. I think the ordinary fundamental meaning as overflow or exudation is a better translation for this reason. What do you overflow into? The realm of desire, karma, or the realm of becoming, I want to become this, I want to achieve that, and so forth, into the realm of all sorts of conceptions and speculations, and into the realm of ignorance. That is what what consciousness overflows into. But when the combination of this ninth stage and the wisdom which sees through into all this is realized, the asavas have completely disappeared. Never again is there any overflow through you, the person, into that state. Therefore, the absolutely pure consciousness remains as such, which the Buddha himself used the phrase, vijnanam anidassanam anantam sabbato pabham. In another context, the word pahang is used, meaning accessible. In the Digha Nikaya, it's pahang, accessible. And in the Majjhima, in the first volume, you'll find the phrase come in. It is pabham, meaning shining. This consciousness which is everlastingly shining, the light of transcendence. But this phrase, surely, at least to my mind, is the equivalent, exact equivalent of the Upanishadic Atma. That is the kind of thing that has been said about the Atma. And in Buddhist terminology, they use the whole phrase. Atta, of course, is the Pali equivalent of Atma. But in conventional Buddhism, the definition of Atma is a misdefinition. You know how with the Upanishads, the pre-Buddhistic Upanishads unequivocally stated, the Chandogya, for example, unequivocally stated, the Atma is the unborn, the unaging, the undying, the stainless, and so forth. And that is precisely what the Buddha declares he was seeking in his Ariya Pariyesana Sutta, where he talks about his quest, the quest for the supreme good. And those are the very items which are mentioned there. So it is very significant that the term Atta in Pali really stands for, originally, the Atma as presented in the pre-Buddhistic Upanishads. It's in the later Upanishads that you get this rather unfortunate entry of the Atma, the size of a thumb, situated in the heart, and so forth and so forth, and this mannequin soul which displaced the transcendent absolute comes into being. And of course that concept of the Atma is just hopeless. Everything which is manifest therefore is declared to be anatta. The Atta is the unborn, the undying, the infinite, the eternal, the immortal. How can one associate that with that which is born, proceeds, and dies? So, when these two aspects are realized in complete harmony, the entry into the profoundest meditative state, the profoundest meditative state, and the wisdom which sees the truth, the true nature of things, and is free of the asavas. So then that spells nirvana, the nirvanic condition. The word nirvana, as you mean, means it's burnt out, something burnt out. Well, what is burnt out? All that is obstructive to the infinite, the eternal, and the immortal. In the Subala Upanishad, which is a very interesting Upanishad indeed, in the 15th section, the question gets asked, what happens when the intelligential soul, the Atma, goes towards its culmination? And the answer from the teacher is that it burns up this, that, and the other. Everything that can be experienced, everything that can be mentioned or thought of is burnt up. And then he proceeds to say it burns up the imperishable, it burns up the totality and everything, and finally death becomes one with the Lord. And the words are, this is the teaching of Nirvana, this is the teaching of the Vedas. It's very, very interesting. Death becomes one with the Lord. In the Gita, as so many of you know, Sri Krishna says, I am being and non-being am I. Death and the origin of all things to come am I. Now, what is the significance of saying being and non-being am I? Being, there are innumerable beings in the world, individual beings as such. And when the being disappears, when he dies, he is resolved into the one and only all-embracing non-being. Non-being is one, non-existence, one may say. There is one non-being, and there is this sort of pulsation between the one non-being and the innumerable beings, the one and the many. The one expresses out of its own self the multitudinous many, and the multitudinous many run their course and all return back to this one non-being. It's not easy to sort of grasp this, and it is very difficult to try and expound it. But if you can sort of get the feel of it, you will see some quite extraordinary things. The context of limited being, the context of anything which is limited, is the context of the finite, the temporal, and the mortal. The context of the transcendence is the infinite, eternal, and immortal. Yesterday we considered for a few moments eternity as not being synonymous with timelessness. We saw that both time and timelessness are bound by time as such, because the experience of timelessness begins and it comes to an end, and the limits are time. The body's needs have to be attended to. Whereas eternity subsumes both time and timelessness and is totally indescribable. So now there are these sort of two contexts, but it must be borne in mind that the context of the finite and the mortal is subsumed by the infinite and immortal. That is the unborn, the unbecome, unmade, etc., etc. Now, going through the fourth jhana brings about what I would call the passage through the second portal of death, because all sensory impressions disappear. That means your contact with that which is the finite and the mortal has ceased. When you enter the samapatis, the coalescences with the universal mind and with universal archetypal energies which function. And remember that these energies have been symbolized in the great religions in the names of the archangels and angels and so forth. When you enter that, you have experienced the passage through the second portal of death. And in the ninth stage, there is the passage through the third portal of death, the final death, which is where, as in the Subala Upanishad, death has become one with the Lord. Now, one question has been asked, which I haven't yet answered. For 3 days. You have stated that at death we have the complete end of the psychophysical organism. How then do you relate this to the theory of rebirth and to phenomena such as apparitions, etc.? I don't relate it to the theory of rebirth. I reject completely the popular picture, the popular ideas which are built up in connection with rebirth. Or you can use the word reincarnation, or transmigration, or palingenesis, or metensomatosis, or you use what word you like, you see. But it all means one thing. If you look deeply into your own mental functioning and observe what exactly is in your mind when you talk about rebirth, there is always this basic idea of an identifiable entity. Now, we have been taught, and some of us have realized also through actual experience, that there's no such thing as a permanent identifiable entity. When theistic religions present God as an entity, a personal entity, then it's a self-contradictory definition, because entity is born, proceeds and dies. There is no getting away from that. You can't have an immortal entity. That state of the immortal is something where separate entity as such, persisting through time, doesn't exist. If we believe that, and we say that God is the eternal and at the same time a separate entity, we are, I think, not talking very wisely. I may be wrong, but that's how I see things. Now, the creation of the universe is this pulse of creation is an extraordinary thing altogether. In this ninth stage, with the disappearance, with the ending of perception and feeling, even the transcendental perception and feeling, you get into tune with the pulse of creation. This pulse of creation takes place with extraordinary rapidity, which one's consciousness cannot follow. Therefore we see it as a continuity, but the pulse of creation in itself is a discontinuous throb. It is a throb which produces the entire universe at one and the same time, one and the same instant, let me say. And this is repeated with extraordinary rapidity. I use the word instant, but actually this throb is non-repetitive. At every throb, the entire universe is new, including you and me and our consciousness and everything. But because our ordinary everyday consciousness is so slow moving, we see it as a continuity. Just as if you take a string and have a light at the one end of it and twirl that string at a sufficient speed, you will see a whole continuous circle of light. But it is not a continuous circle of light, as you know. Now, it's the same with this pulse of creation. It takes place with extraordinary rapidity, and the universe is created new every time, absolutely new every time. It's rather difficult to see this. There is no causality in this process. Causality doesn't apply to transcendence at all. Transcendence is utterly free of a sequence of cause and effect. It is acausal and it is irrational. Neither rational nor irrational. It is irrational and acausal. This pulse of creation is what you get into tune with it, as if supposing you sort of look at the pulse of creation as the top C of the piano, and the bottom C will vibrate at a speed which has a proper relationship with that top C, and the number of vibrations of the top C contain the number of vibrations of your bottom C. In that sense, so to say, and these analogies are very difficult. You are in tune with that, and this is the sort of experiencing by the great mystics and the great spiritual geniuses of the world when they realize this transcendental condition. I dare say something like that may have been experienced by Eckhart, which made him say, "Man verily is God, God verily is man." Outspoken words, you see. And of course, in the Hindu, and especially the Upanishadic writings, man is identified with God as the supreme in potentiality. That potentiality comes to fruition and fulfillment with his complete purification. This pulse is non-repetitive. It is absolutely new. It is not a modification of the old. Do remember that. It's not like what happens when we rearrange the furniture in the room. It's not that. It's completely new every time. It's very difficult to grasp that, and it's discontinuous. There is no continuity about it. When the new comes into being as the result of the total transmutation of the previous of the universe of the previous instant, a fraction of an instant, in fact. Now, let us take this word karma. It's derived from kri. The dictionary meaning is to do or to make. But that is rather a poor meaning. Karma is to create. It's action in eternity. Here again, we can bring in the help of Sri Krishna's statement. When he tells Arjuna, if I did not engage in action, constantly engage in action, these worlds would fall into ruin. Remember, Krishna is regarded as God, as the absolute incarnate. If I did not engage in action, this is action in eternity, not action in the world as we know it. If I did not engage constantly in action, these worlds would fall into ruin. The pulse of creation would disappear, and there would be nothing at all. Pralaya, as the Upanishads talked of. So, that is the first and fundamental meaning of karma. Creative action in eternity. It is transcendent. It is transcendental. There is no cause-effect sequence, because eternity is free of the constraints of time, although eternity rides on the wings of time. In every infinitesimal split second, eternity is embodied. This is the extraordinary thing, that the infinite, the eternal, and the immortal are embodied in the finite, the temporal, and the mortal. We ordinary human beings cannot sort of thrill to that in innermost consciousness. And do remember that that which you can thrill to in innermost consciousness is something which you can actually do quite naturally and spontaneously. It happens. Causality holds in the existential sphere only. and on the macrocosmic level, not on the microcosmic, not at the microcosmic level. You know, in the subatomic level sphere, there is no our ideas of causality just don't hold. It doesn't work that way. It's only on the big scale that causality holds good, and we have a time sequence involved in it. But in transcendence, there is no such thing as a time sequence. Eternity knows no time sequence. Now, the five khandhas which constitute us, the body, the shape, the sensations, the feelings, the thoughts, and so forth, and discriminative consciousness, which composes the existential being. Every one of us is an existential being as such. And the Buddha taught, and quite rightly, that none of these elements composing us is immortal. It is constantly perishing, undergoing change and finally perishing. So now, when the body dies, all these elements completely die with it. The whole psychophysical organism dies as such. You may ask then, how does karma work out? Karma works out because whatsoever we do, whatsoever we are as a being, is all resolved into the one primordial non-being as such. And in that non-being, transcendence wipes the slate clean. We do not have to pay penalties for our wrongdoings in future lives, nor will we receive any rewards for the good in future lives, nor did we have any past lives as such. There is a good scientific reason for this. Consider how the existential being, this body, is born. Born of a father and a mother. Now the each parent produces a generative cell, the gamete, and this generative cell is quite different from ordinary non-reproductive cells. The gamete is formed by a rearrangement of the genetic material derived from the father's parents and from the mother's parents. When the two gametes unite, they form a zygote which grows into the new individual as such. Now, the extraordinary nature of this whole process is such that the new individual is completely new in every respect. There never was anybody like that individual before, and never will be again. This immense variety is one of the miracles of life and the living process, the generating process. Now, when the body dies, all the thoughts and feelings and the memories and so forth, which are embedded in the brain and the nervous system, the central nervous system, it completely dies, and all of it just disappears. Just as if you cut off a branch of grapes from a grapevine, all those grapes will just perish with the cutting off of that branch. They will never sort of come to fruition. They will never ripen or anything like that. They will all go, absolutely. The existential undergoes a complete dissolution, a complete death. It is that which is non-existential, the transcendent itself, which is the eternal, the self-subsisting and the self-replenishing. Whatsoever we do and so forth has its influence, if you like, on that one non-being, which is the transcendent. And that non-being expresses out of its self the innumerable beings. But there is no such thing as an identifiable entity in that state of non-being. This is the point. Nothing which is an identifiable entity. So that karma works in an extraordinary way, as I suggested. Mind you, this is my suggestion, and please, as I've said again and again, don't believe a word of what I said. Consider it, if you like, if you feel you'd like to pursue the matter, consider it, but don't believe it, or, if I may suggest, don't reject it out of hand. I have known extraordinary freedom emerge because of seeing something of this sort. In the world process. Karma works out because transcendence wipes the slate clean. It's the infinite mercy, the infinite compassion of the divine. In Islam too, they always refer to Allah as the all-compassionate, merciful one. But whether he wipes the slate clean is a little bit doubtful, because the Quran definitely says that if Allah wills, you will go into hell. You see, Allah wills, the will of a supreme, absolute, capricious God. That is the weak point, I think, of the presentation in Islam. Although Islam, no religion has presented the absoluteness of God as Islam has done. However, that is not of any very great importance at the moment. So, in relation to individual karma, as I said, transcendent wipes the slate clean. We don't like that. Hitler, Torquemada, and all that ilk, our vengefulness wants to see them punished. But does the transcendence want to see an individual punished? It's questionable. Transformed, transmuted. And that is precisely what happens when the being, the individual being, is resolved into the non-being, into the totality, the absolute. A transmutative process takes place because of the nature of the pulse of creation at work. A completely transmutative process. So it's the Lord, if you like, who drinks to the dregs the cup of the world's evil, transmutes that in his own being, and once again puts out a new person. Remember, always new. At the physical level too, the new individual is totally new. Nothing comes over from a past because of the change. Of the genetic material which makes the gamete in the father and in the mother. It's a complete change. Our conceptions of causality do not hold good with transcendence, whose action in eternity, as I have already mentioned, is acausal and irrational. Now, you may say, but the Buddha himself said in several of the discourses, when he's talking of somebody in the past, and he says, now Ananda, that is not to be understood as that. I was so and so, you were so and so, Yasodhara, his wife, was so and so, and so on, so and so. The Buddha uses the word aham, I am. Now, what is the significance of the I, the word I, as used by a Buddha or any perfected holy one? Aham is the unabandonable. It is the absolute, the eternal. That is what aham is. You will find this expounded in one of the Puranas. The unabandonable. Therefore, it is the transcendent. And transcendence is only one, a one reality as such. Absolutely one. And the perfected Holy One who has become utterly free of all obstructions to transcendence is at one with transcendence, and the aham refers to transcendence. And therefore, it is that one transcendence which expresses itself and all these different people and their lives and so on emerge. So in that sense, I am so and so. Consider again in Exodus, the Lord God says to Moses when he asks, if the Israelites ask me who has sent you, say unto them, Ehye Asher Ehye. I am that I am, the one and only absolute reality has sent you. Ehye Asher Ehye. And when the term I is used, it's not in the sense when it is used by the perfected holy ones, it is not used in the existential sense at all. It is used in this transcendent sense. And on the whole, we have failed to appreciate that. So, as regards this question, the psychophysical organism, the existential being, completely dies, just like the leaves of a tree completely perish. And next year, the tree, the one thing, puts forth new leaves. They are new. They are not a reincarnation or rebirth of the old leaves. We are like that. So, you will see that I do not relate it to rebirth in the conventional sense at all. The spirit in us, which we talk about, the immortal spirit and so forth, is not an identifiable entity. It's not separate from the supreme, one and only supreme spirit. The absolute, the transcendence itself. The totality is embodied in the finite. That's the marvel of the totality. I think I've spoken too much today.